another episode of the Traveling Entertainer Podcast. So, this next round of episodes is with Philly's finest musical export, Mr. Garrett Dutton, a.k.a. G-Love of G-Love and Special Sauce. If you have listened to the podcast before or just know me personally, then you will know that I'm easily one of the biggest fans of Garrett's career. But for those that might be new to G-Love's music, here's the briefest of all overviews. Back in 1993, G-Love was signed to one of the last large old-school record deals from a major label, being Epic Sony, where he ultimately released five records under the Sony label. His first major label release was the self-titled record G-Love and Special Sauce, which has gone platinum and sold over a million records. He followed that up with Coast to Coast Motel in 1995, Yeah It's That Easy in 1997, and as a side note, this record featured the late great Dr. John on piano. Cut to 1999 and G-Love released Philadelphonic, which started his long-term friendship with Jack Johnson on their collaboration for the song Rodeo Clowns. G-Love's final record with Sony was The Electric Mile in 2001, but at the end of his contract with Sony, Sony decided to hastily put out a greatest hits record, which sent Garrett looking for a new record label, which he ultimately found in his friend Jack Johnson through the Brushfire record label. Between 2003 to 2015, Garrett released several records under the Brushfire moniker, being The Hustle in 2003, Lemonade in 2006, Superhero Brother in 2008, Fixing to Die in 2010, Sugar in 2014, bringing back the original trio, and Love Saves the Day in 2015. He's also released several bootlegs that you could buy at his live shows, which include G-Love in the King's Court, G-Love Gone Country, Back in the Day, and his first acoustic demo tape called Oh Yeah. Not to mention two Australian-only releases, which were Long Way Down in 2009, followed by Plutonic and G-Love's Moonshine Lemonade in 2011. Also, there's a live DVD record called A Year in the Life, which chronicles the band on tour over the course of a year, and is an interesting view into the insides of the grilling tour schedule the band usually maintains. There's a Christmas record released in 2017, and his most released was The Juice in January of 2020, produced by Grammy Award-winning artist Keb Moe. Now here's the point of all this blathering. Garrett has been a non-stop touring and recording artist for almost 30 years. He averages 150 shows annually, which is an insane amount of travel for anyone. He's been around the world more times than you can count and has been in front of countless audiences, and I personally think he replaced James Brown as the hardest working man in show business a long time ago. He created a rag mop style of music called the hip hop blues, which is 100% unique to his own style, and from where I'm sitting, G-Love is easily one of the most original American songwriters and performers for the past three decades. Also, special thanks goes out to Mike Hannigan on G-Love's management team for setting up the interview to begin with, which was originally scheduled during his tour for The Juice, which got canceled due to COVID. Anyways, without further delay, here is that conversation with Garrett Dutton, a.k.a. G-Love.
No more lies about this, no more lies about that. No more ace up your sleeve, please just lay your cards flat. See how seats that are rough when the struggle is tough. Bad news on the news every day, it's enough to make good people turn around and leave. How about we march in the streets and we raise our fists in the air? Cause we do care, you say who cares, we do.
Hey Garrett, thanks for being on the Traveling Entertainer Podcast. So, first question. How's it going during these COVID times? How you holding up? And is there any silver lining for you taking all this time off from touring?
This is another one of the great silver linings of this thing. And I will preface it by saying that we just were in the middle, just the first quarter of what was hopefully going to be a really huge year for us with the record release of The Juice, produced by five-time Grammy Award winner Keb Moe, with the goal to try to get a Grammy nomination as a kind of an industry goal, and a wonderful batch of songs to me, one of the great records I've put out ever, you know, and of course that's what artists say about all the new shit, but I really feel that way, and I don't always feel that way, and especially feel that way about the songs. So talk about, like you said, get the rug pulled out underneath us. And as far as Jim, Jeff and I, the Special Sauce, we were really enjoying this tour. And, you know, Jeff and I, the drummer, usually get into it badly during the course of a tour at some point, and usually end up not speaking to each other for weeks at a time. And, man, we really were getting along so great, man. And everybody was happy, and the band was coming up with some great versions of the new songs. So we were really, like, cracking. And it was a bummer. And we were going to come to Europe twice. We were going to come to Japan. We were going to Australia and all over the U.S. and Canada. So really, like, stopped. So bummer for the special sauce. And, of course, we don't live. Jim lives in Portland, Oregon. Jeff lives in Nashville, and I live in Cape Cod, right? So, so then what happened? So basically, there's, I call them shipwrecked musicians, right? Everyone's kind of shipwrecked. Everyone's both, you know, shipwrecked. So there's a lot of musicians off the road, including some guys from Slightly Stupid that live in New England, Daniel De La Cruz, a.k.a. De La, and Paulie Dubs, Paul Waldencraft, the organ player from Slightly Stupid. Well, De La lives in Rhode Island. Paul lives in Boston. And De La said, hey, I want to put together this drive-in show. And he might have hit me in July, so we're going to try and do it in August. All right, well, you know, he went on, of course, let's do it. So he put together this killer band. And so then we booked a warm-up gig at the Hog Island Brewery. And all of a sudden, like, it was like, wow, okay, this is pretty amazing. And then so it's those two guys from Slightly Stupid and a bunch of Boston, New England musicians. These are all just amazing musicians and, like, all Berkeley guys, but guys that have been, that were, you know, did some time at Berkeley, but also have just been, like, gigging for years and years and, you know, all masters of the craft, basically, and just great instincts and great guys. And so, yes, yeah, so we were able to put together, and great guys and gals, I should say. But, yeah, we were able to put together this kind of unit that has kind of a rotating cast of these New England musicians and put together a set which has some classic G-Love tunes, a bunch of stuff off my new record. We started writing songs, and I started kind of delving into some of my collaborations that I've done over the years, like with Jack and with Jack Johnson, and lately with Mahali from Twiddle, and the version of Malamud that I did with Slightly Stupid. So we have this great set of music, and so yeah, it's been a real silver lining, and it's been great for me to play with a bigger band with, like, horns and organ and another lead guitar player, a lot of soloists. It's been a whole new musical experience. It's been a real silver lining, like, you know, to be able to, like, you know, get to jam with these guys. And to the point that I don't know what I'm going to do when things go back to normal, because I feel like this band could really help me to get back to kind of some of the bigger stages, because it's a bigger sound. At least that's what I would hope for, you know.
Two things that I wanted to talk to you about before I get into the meat of what I'm supposed to be talking about. Well, one of them is, you know, your career is so vast and so long, and you've got just an amazing group of collaborations underneath your belt. You know, Dave Hidalgo from Los Lobos, the late, great Dr. John, Jack Johnson, Slightly Stupid, Cisco Adler, Lucinda Williams, you know, the list goes on and on and on. The question that I had is, are there any people on your bucket list that you haven't collaborated with yet that you're actively trying to work with?
You know, it's been one of the greatest parts of my life, and I say that, like, not just my career, my life, to get to share the stage and be in the studio and tour with such wonderful human beings and wonderful legendary musicians and people that I grew up idolizing. And then people that, you know, looked up to me that have gone, that I kind of helped along and have gone on to huge success. I've always kind of felt like, and I really switch, I didn't really have a lot of natural talent. Like, I didn't have a natural sense of rhythm. It took me, I don't have a natural sense of tone. For instance, I started playing guitar at 8. I couldn't tune it on my own until I was 13. I had no rhythm. Like, my guitar teacher would have to put my foot on top of his foot and tap his foot so I could literally feel the beat. I'm not any type of, like, singer. I was never trained. I was never, like, I didn't make the choir. You know, I tried out for choir in senior year. I hated choir, but by senior year in high school, I was
knew that I wanted to be a musician, so I said, well, I should try for choir. It could help my singing, because I was writing songs and singing. I didn't make choir. I tried out and was denied, right? So I basically had no natural talent across the board. What did I have? I mean, I had a real passion. I knew this feeling that music gave me to play, and I always had something to say with my lyrics, and I always had this desire to like be on stage and to get to perform, and I worked really hard at it. You know what I mean? So,
sure.
To anybody that says, "Oh, I can't carry a tune," or "I can't play basketball," and whatever it is, like I can't paint, whatever it is, like anybody can do anything. You know, if you look at any interviews from anybody from Picasso to Michael Jackson, to Bob Dylan, to Lady Gaga, you'll see that most of their success and their greatness comes from their work ethic. You know what I mean?
No, I'd agree. But here's the thing is, I think you're selling yourself completely short, and you might be your worst enemy, because I've seen you since the first show you played at the Crocodile Cafe in Seattle up to venues all around the world. I've seen you in Paris perform a few times and all around the United States of America, and listen, man, I mean, you've become one hell of a lyricist and a songwriter, and your skills on the harmonica and the harp and playing the guitar, if you didn't have rhythm then, you sure as hell have rhythm now. So I think you might be misdiagnosing the amount of talent that you have.
Well, I really appreciate that, and I don't want to get the feeling like I'm beating myself up or I don't realize that I have talent. I realize now. I mean, I just wanted to kind of make the point that it comes from the work. There are people that I see that I know that have great, like, you know, kind of natural talent. They've also done the work, but they have a certain thing that maybe I wasn't born with. That's all I'm saying, is that I've been able to transform. I've been able to mold myself through my work ethic and my passion, right, into a world-class musician. And I know that I can get on stage and step on stage with and in the studio with all legendary people you just mentioned, whether it's, you know, Jack or John Hammond or Run-DMC or the Avett Brothers or Dr. John, the Buddy Guy, or anybody. Like, on stage, I've shared the stage with the masters, the true masters, in almost every genre, because of the fact that where my music lands, right? I've been able to share the stage with anybody from like Willie Nelson to Run-DMC, right?
Yep.
And everybody in between. And we've also inspired people from like rappers to folk singers and bluegrass players, right? Because of the wide range of our tunes. So the collaborations, I mean, the long story short is that the collaborations, the getting to share time with these people, that's been the most delicious part of my whole life, you know. It's unbelievable. And just because everyone's so cool, and musicians are generally beautiful people, you know, especially musicians that have gained success because they're all living their dream, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's how it goes. They've all achieved to be able to, you know, to pursue their passion as their life's work. And that's when, you know, there's the age old saying, yeah, if you do what you love, you never work a day in your life. Right? That's what all these people just do. And these are people that are empathetic and sensitive and emotional and all the redeeming qualities you think people should strive for in humanity. So, yeah, long story short, so the question was, who I want to collaborate with, it's hard for me to say, because my latest collaboration with Kedmo, who is an old label mate of mine, we both got signed in 1993, was so wonderful. Like, Kev Mo took me into a master class of not only the blues, but of music and history of music. And I didn't know that he had so much. I didn't know he had that much. And it was unbelievable.
And you guys took your time making this record, right? This one, you know, it wasn't like Love Saves the Day. I think you guys probably spent like 7 to 9 days in the studio and banged it out real quick.
Right.
But with
yeah.
The Juice, this one sounded like it was a long-term investment, and, you know, you weren't just pounding out the recording sessions.
That's right. It was, it really took place over 3 years, and it started kind of as a writing session, and then kind of moved into demoing. Basically, like we would, the process was we would write and demo a song. And then those songs became the working tracks of the record. And the specials happened sporadically over the course of 3 years with, of course, like kind of a final push to be like, okay, we have the record now. We're going to do like, you know, 2 weeks and use these demos that we have and now really like put the icing on the cake. But that was cool. So like that collaboration gave me so much. And then I got thinking like who else I want to collaborate with. Like the answer is always like whoever feels great to play music with. I'd love to collaborate with Gary Tanner Jr. I'd love to collaborate with Jack. I'd love to collaborate with Dan Auerbach. Those are some of my contemporaries that, you know, I know that they all like love what we do and, you know, I love what they do. They've been able to achieve so much.
But hey, I want to go back to one other thing, like, kind of circle back on something when you talked about, you know, the songwriting on the Juice. It's interesting, and I kind of want to draw a parallel here because I think when you released your record Fixing to Die, I feel like that record is a standout record for you, not just because the Abbott Brothers were introduced to sort of the world and it's a great record, but more so because I feel like your lyrics on that particular record are extremely strong, and it seemed like one of the first times you made a concerted effort to get away from, you know, sort of the party vibe lyrics that you're extremely good at as well. And I feel like that record in particular, Fixing to Die, is a lot like the Juice in that way, where it's not the biggest G-Love and Special Sauce record, but it really is a G-Love record, and it's a little bit different. Does that sound right, or did at that period in your life, were you looking to make a record that was different than what you'd done before?
Yeah, man, Mike, I got to say that's very intuitive of you. Like, I think Emmett Malloy from Brushfire Records, he kind of said at the time, he's like, you know, he thinks of like records and kind of groups of three. So we had just done, with Brushfire Records, we had done The Hustle, which was kind of like a, you know, we're back record, did pretty well and set us up for the success we had on Lemonade, which is one of our better selling records. And then Superhero Brother Records is so weird because The Hustle, I thought, was the most epic thing ever, and it did just okay. And Lemonade, I thought, was just okay, and it did really well. And Superhero Brother, I thought, was, I put so much work into that, and that, again, just did okay. So, after that, we're like, well, what do we do? So, long story short, The Hustle, Lemonade, Superhero Brother were like kind of a trifecta, and then so, well, I was trying to flip the script. So, I had met the Abbott Brothers, and they were big fans, and I became a huge fan of them right away. And so, we kept running into them and jamming, and so we said, man, let's, and they were having this huge moment, like they're, you know, big upsurge in their career, which has continued. It was just like, well, let's see if they'll produce a record and kind of go back to my roots. It was like, so before I got into the blues, I was really influenced by Bob Dylan and like kind of bluegrass and folk music. And that was before I found the Delta Blues and certainly before I fucked with hip hop. So, well, I was always messing with hip hop, but musically I was a folk, kind of folk coffee house. So, that was the thing, was like, let's go back to the roots of the coffee shop and kind of do the Fixing to Die record. And that was good, and that was cool because it was like different and it was a change up. I think the Avery Brothers were kind of bummed because I think they would have liked to rather have done more like funky stuff, because there was the only close thing to any type of thing was hip hop was the song Just Fine, and they were like, this is the shit, you know? Because
yeah.
They, and I was the blues and the folk, and, but they did an amazing job producing. It was like a really special record to make, and but yeah, that was it. It was kind of more serious, kind of heartfelt, emotional record, and certainly, yes, took kind of stepping away from the funky sound of Special Sauce and some of the more like crowd-driven type of writing and. Yeah, certainly party tunes. We didn't really have that shown on that record. So yeah, it was good. It was the right time to make that, and then that led to like
the next three, which is Sugar, which was kind of the kind of, yeah, basically a fictional guy that kind of inserted us and said, look, D-Love's like not like whatever you have misconceptions when it's like a party band or whatever, like, no, like, this is a real artist. Like, I'm a real artist. They write real songs, rooted in Delta blues, Americana, and folk music. Like, I was making folk music before there was a type of music called Americana. So, like, this is my roots, right? So, this establishing us and saying, well, hey, we're in this too. You know what I mean? We're a part of this too.
Yeah, no, for sure.
And then that kind of gave us the confidence to kind of get back into the blues, which then Sugar was like, you know, especially us playing more electric style blues. And then Life Space Today was kind of I felt like following up on the footsteps of Sugar and we're executing perfectly what Sugar set out to do. That's the way I look at it.
Now, and you know, one of the things that I've loved about the band, what you've done on, I want to say most records, is I love it when a band comes out and plays the whole thing front to back, or just skips the order up but does the entire record and just plays the hell out of it. Because that, you know, I've always thought you're recording it, and you guys kind of record live to begin with, but all I'm saying is when you guys come out and you play a song like Peanut Butter Lips, you kill it, right? And it shows off the talent of the band when the trio's together and you guys are rocking these songs out. And that might not have been the case at the beginning of your career. I don't know if you guys could have done, it's that easy. That'd be a hard record for the three of you to pull off together without having backing other people on stage with you. But, you know, when you got on stage with Love Saves the Day or Sugar, you guys could really, you were, in my opinion, I am an artist, and here you go. We're giving it to you as hard as we can.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting, you know, like, certainly I feel like I've been way more confident, again, due to the work and the years of marinating on stage and continuing to pursue my craft vocally, songwriting, harmonica playing, guitar playing. Certainly it feels like the level of musicianship has increased, like our power and what we can do together. Certainly the chemistry between Jim, Jeff and I has deepened with every year and every trial and tribulation that we kind of overcome together. You know, certainly we have the catalog to draw from to be able to, you know, keep doing a fresh show every night. I mean, our shows are spontaneous. You know, there's just been a couple tours where we've done the whole record. We did the first record tour, where we 2020 anniversary, where we performed the whole record in running order from start to finish. And then when Love Saves the Day came out, we did that whole record from in its entirety, not in its running order. So that's the only time we've done a pre-planned set. Otherwise, we're just flying off the cuff, following the vibe, and trying to tell a story that's unique to every night and every group of people that are performing in front of.
Right.
So that's sometimes not so much, but I stand by it, but like I try to deliver a grassroots set that, you know, showcases what's happening at that very moment. And it's like, do you want something fresh from the farm stand, or do you want some cut up fruit from the supermarket? You know what
right.
I mean? So we deliver fresh every night. I will say that, like, for us, the records and the live performance, and therefore the arrangements of the song, the instrumentation of the song is not, to us, like, as important. It's not our goal to go on stage and recreate how the record sounds on the record, or try to, you know, emulate if there's horns on an overdub or keyboard on an overdub. If we don't have that as a trio, that's not, like, that has no bearing on what we're doing that particular night. Like, I get it, like, for the, maybe they would miss some of the harmony, extra harmonies or overdubs and stuff like that, but that's just never been our approach to playing live. Like, for us, it's, like, always about the strength of the song and how that's going to be delivered. And, frankly, even if you record a song that has, you know, 20,000 overdubs on it and a full choir singing, like, for instance, if you take the song You Can't Always Get What You Want by the Rolling Stones, if you heard Mick Jagger just play that on acoustic guitar, it would probably maybe move you just the same as the recorded version with the whole choir does. That's what we're trying to do.
Well, so here's another thing that I'd like to point out too. It seems like you brought so many opening bands up, you know, with you along the road over the course of the last 25, 30 years, and a lot of the times it seems like for those big songs like Weekend Dance that sounds a lot better if you've got a horn in the back, you're pulling in some of the, you know, opening band guys to kind of fill in that void. Do you, when you're taking these artists out on the road and you're you know, you're going to spend however long it is, 6 weeks, 8 weeks with them, are you looking, ever thinking, all right, I can pull this guy in and he can be up on stage for three or four songs and make it sound a little bit better? Make it sound more like a you know, the recorded version, if you will, or does that never go through your mind?
No, I mean, that absolutely goes through my mind. Like, it's twofold. For one thing, I don't know, about 10 or 12 or 15 years ago, we kind of looked at our show and said, well, we have an opportunity here to deliver not only our show, but someone else's show that we believe in and help somebody that we believe in, i.e. a great opening act, to deliver a full night of music that we truly believe in. And so it became a curation. We've been able to help some really wonderful musicians and put together some really killer lineups. And I think we've kind of got a reputation that if you're coming to a G-Love show, you ought to go see the opening act because it's curated and it's something that we believe in and it's going to be great. You know what I mean? Or else it wouldn't be there. You know what I mean? Simple as that. And certainly, I like to take people on the road that I want to make music with and that can help me to lift up our show. Because just like you said, like, you know, we're a trio. So if we're able to bring out a horn or a great lead guitar player or a great singer or whatever for a couple of tunes, it's just nice for the fans to mix it up sonically. And it's fun for us. So it's
for sure.
A win-win.
So if you bring a band on tour, these guys aren't sleeping on your tour bus, right? They're huffing it on their own behind you guys.
Hell no.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. One of the things I was wondering about in your career is, you know, when you were talking about earlier, you want a bigger sound. You want to get up on these bigger stages. At one point, you guys were a foursome, and you had Mark Boyce kind of with you. And I know that Mark Boyce is still actively recording with you. In the last couple of records, he shows up in sessions. But what happened with that? Well, at one particular point, did you decide, let's go back to a threesome? Because I love the sound with the fourth person on stage.
Well, I'll tell you why. And actually, we had five piece. We had Chuck Treese and Jeff on drums, and then Jim and Mark. And then, honestly, Mike, it's financial. It was like we got off, you know, again, it's like we had this run going. And up till 2008, and then we kind of headlined Red Rocks 2 years in a row, and then Superhero Brother came out, and it really didn't do well. Around the same time, I had a vocal injury, and which required surgery, and leading up to that was a year of probably, through the fans' perspective, lackluster performances, although I was just trying to make it through this grueling schedule without further injuring my voice. So like every night, instead of like going out and letting loose, I was just trying to protect my voice and make it to the next show and to the end of the run. So it was like a tough couple of years, and basically kind of came out of that, you know, numbers started, our ticket buying audience declined. And so, you know, just figured out like, oh yeah, you just toured all year long and, you know, you did this amount of shows and, well, how much you make? Well, you made, you know, $30,000. Well, geez, how can we get rid of that? Well, if we slim down our bands, then I can, you know, it's just like I can come back to we're a business. It's people don't understand, but like the music bands are small businesses, right? So,
yep.
Unfortunately, that's what it came down to. It was like a layoff. Like, we're not taking anything to bottom line. I'm grueling schedule all year long. It's not going in the right direction. We're going to have to scale back. So we had to let go Mark, and we had to let go our lighting guy, Mikey Ledesma. And it was a sad day when we had to give that word. And there were tears cried by everybody because we were all brothers, you know. But, you know, that was unfortunate. And I wish it didn't have to be like that? Yeah. But like we moved on, and you know, the same time, like it was pretty cool, and you know, same time, like going back to the trio was like not like we're going from a five piece band to a trio. It's like we're going back to our original sound, And part of the success we had was because we were a great trio, and not too many trios are great. Well, if you're a trio, you have to be great. You know what I mean? Like, everyone has to be able to pull their weight. So we had to go back for a trio. But to be clear, it was not creative. It was not, like, personality issues. It was all to do with financials. And it's always been kind of a dream of mine to, like, get back to it. Because I'm going to be honest with you, man. Like, if I have an extra soloist or two or three in the band or an extra vocalist, the hardest thing about touring is keeping your voice up and being able to, and every time you have a minute to rest your voice during a show, even if it's just for 8 bars during an organ solo, like, that benefits your next approach to singing the next verse.
Sure.
You can sing it stronger because you just got a second for your body to recover. It's like that. It's like people don't really think of musicians being like athletes, but that's why when you're watching a hoops game, they got to take LeBron James out of the game in the fourth quarter for two minutes, let him rest so he can make his final push. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you don't have the extra players to help you get that little bit of rest, then you're just, you'd be exhausted and your voice gets raggedy.
What I find interesting in your situation is that, you know, you started out in the young, tender age of 20-something and massive record contract with Sony, well-received record when it came out, which took you all over the world, most likely for the first time. Do you remember the first time that you got booked in a gig outside of the United States of America and what that response was?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first place we came was to Europe. It was to London. And we probably came to Paris soon after. And I remember, it was pretty exciting. I mean, we came to London. We played someplace down at Camden. We played Ronnie Scott. We played on the Jules Holland show. It was like, you know, it was crazy. We went from street musicians to, like, getting a big pile of money, working, like, being on the fringe of society to, like, working for the biggest corporation, one of the biggest corporations in the world, Sony Music. So all of a sudden, like, you know, flying to London and, you know, getting picked up in a limo and driven to this fancy hotel and getting to play on TV shows. And it was, and I was just totally spun out, you know, and I don't know how the hell we did it, but I was a kid. I know that the passion for the music was so amazing, but it was hard, you know, and it never really felt comfortable. We were grinding so hard, you know, so you just be constantly on the move. I felt like I was always being judged, like, people weren't just coming to the music to, like, hang out and, like, party and dance. People were coming to, like, say, oh, you know, okay, I've heard about these guys, or can these guys play? And then, like, there's a whole other thing, like, in Europe, which is, like, you know, the historical vantage point of the European music writer. How are you a white kid whose father was a lawyer from Philadelphia, so young, playing the Delta Blues? What gives you the right? You know, who are you? What do you, you know what I mean? All this shit, man. It was like, you know, I was just a kid trying to play some music, and it was my thing, you know. So it's like a constant thing. Like, every night you had to go out and, like, prove it. You had to prove it, like, every night. And a lot of pressure like that. There were some tough crowds and some tough nights, but, you know, man, we were hardcore too. Like, we also didn't give a fuck, you know. We knew exactly what we were trying to deliver, which was this raw, you know, hip hop blues thing that we created. We knew that no one else was doing it. We knew that we were proud that we were doing hip hop and not using any machines or loops or anything like that, because Beck was at the same time and having, like, even more success than us. But his thing was like a produced thing. They weren't like musicians. It was like, thought it was, it was contrived. It wasn't. We were making records like John Lee Hooker made records and like Bob Dylan made records. Like, put up the microphone and let us fucking play. You know, this right. was not like looping up shit. There was no vocal overdubs. Like, we were capturing a magic take, like all of the people that we were inspired by did, whether it was John Coltrane or, you know, Johnny Cash or anybody else. Like, we went in the studio and, like, delivered magic takes. We weren't like some kind of made up thing. Like, people couldn't understand, like, how we were able to
come upon this sound, and like, how do they have the right to do it, and where did it come from? And we were just, it was real, because that's what it was. Just, I was a thing. It was like, I was completely a product of the city that I was born out of. I was a product of living in the city of Philadelphia and having friends from all walks of life, from all, you know, different ethnicities, from, you know, writing graffiti and breakdancing and playing basketball and being a part of like hip hop culture. Even though I never aspired to be a rapper, but by the time I did become a rapper, it was like, oh yeah, I can be a rapper, because actually this is my life, you know, like I did this shit, you know, like I was part of hip hop, you know, so I was the white boy in doing it, you know, but like, I was still in it, you know what I mean? And it was real. So, and as far as like the blues, I was a passionate student of the blues. So, and then if you talk to John Hammond, told me a story. He said when he played with Muddy Waters, Muddy Waters asked him, man, how'd you learn how to play the blues like that? And John said, man, well, from listening to all the records. And Muddy Waters looked at John Hammond and said, damn, me too. You know what I mean? So, you know, long story short, it's like, nobody invented this shit. Robert Johnson didn't even invent it. There was someone that was doing it before him that he learned from. So it's like, you know, everyone learns it, and it's just how much do you love it? You know, how much do you want?
In your guys' situation, too, like, look, I've seen you guys since the day you released your first record, and I've seen you probably play every single record live as well. Again, this is a fan talking. And when I first saw you guys, there was just that moment on stage when I saw you at the Crocodile Cafe where it was just like, holy fuck, these guys are going to be someone. Because, you know, no one else had that sound, right? And it didn't even matter if you, back then, you didn't think you had the writing skills or the skills to play the harp or play the guitar. It was still dripping with, it was just that magic, right? So what I find interesting in what you're saying is that you actually had to prove yourself in front of an international audience as opposed to just people were loving the music.
Yeah, I mean, maybe a lot of that was in my head. I don't know, but, you know, you know, man, it's like this, man. It's like, and first of all, Mike, thank you so much for, wow, I'm blown away. Like, thank you so much for supporting us through all those shows and everything like that. And I'm not trying to, like, talk myself down or, like, I'm very confident and impressed with myself. You know, like, I have a lot of love for myself and a lot of love for the people that I work with, and respect and confidence in what we can achieve, you know what I mean? And I do feel like we've always been a bit of the underdog, and I do feel like we've gotten, yeah, well, we've probably made some mistakes, but we never really got we never really cracked it wide open. Things didn't always work in our favor in the music business like I've seen for some other people, but we got a good shot at it, and we've had a wonderful career and continue to enjoy it. But like, I'll say this, like, you know, I still feel like that. Like every night I got to go out and prove it. I got to prove it first to myself. I got to prove it to my band. And I want to give something to everybody that's out there in the audience. You know, I have a mantra like that I say before the show. I won't say the whole thing, but one thing that says, I feel the crowd. I don't judge the crowd, because you never know, like, the person that's not dancing and looking at you the hardest might be your biggest fan out there. And oftentimes it is. I'm like, what is this guy? Why won't they dance? Like, what are they doing? Like, why are they looking like that? You know? And then that would be the person that comes back and said, man, I've been to every show and I love art. You know what I mean? So you never can. It's my job to get on stage and make people happy. And when I boil it down, like, what we're here to do is to make people happy and to inspire people. And I want to inspire people to play music. And I want to inspire people to be better people through my music. And I want to bring love. And that's like, when I boil down my mission, that's what it is. I have a lot of euphoric moments on stage every night. And it's such a wonderful thing. And it's all of the angst and any kind of self-doubt or any kind of trials and tribulations I put myself through or perceive the industry putting me through, and all the arguments that I have advanced, because we all care so much about it, and we all want to be the absolute best versions of ourselves that we can be. And you know, sometimes you fall short of that mark, and so that's the wonderful thing about being a musician. You get up the next day, and you got another gig. You know what I mean? And that's, I'm just happy to have that opportunity every night to get out and just try and do a little better. And that's my goal. every night before I go on stage, I say, tonight I'm going to play my best. Tonight I'll play my greatest show ever. And that's how I push it every fucking night, every night.
Oh, and I see it too. I mean, I love hearing you say that because I think as a long-term fan too, I think your fans get that. I mean, they've all kind of grown up with you, and I'm sure you get new fans all of the time. But you look, I mean, I saw you at the ripe age of 20 something, and now I'm a 47-year-old man still loving.
Okay, we're the same age. I said we're the same age. I just turned 48.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, I see that in your performance, you know, and plus I've followed you, so I've heard you say this before, but I do think that the audience gets it, and I think, you know, one of the best things about the band is longevity, so you might not have hit your career goals, but at the same time, there's no other band that's been around as long as you guys. That's a milestone mark, and you guys are going to hit your 30-year mark pretty damn soon, and that's got to be a big feeling for you, right?
Yeah, it is, and, man, I would say, like, I will say that you kind of blink your eyes and then it's like, 30, you know, close, you know, 30 years of going by, you know, and it's like, it's along the way you see some people make it and you see some people that you thought were going to be huge stars disappear and you see some people come up and you see some people fall off and you see bands come and go and you see new bands coming and old bands going and musicians die and musicians are born and you just like you feel part of this this kind of society like a secret society of these musicians that, you know, the traveling troubadours that have been doing this thing since two cavemen started banging on you know, outside the cave and doing it and it's just such a cool thing to be a part of. And yeah, man, I think that we have a lot of Jim, Jeff and I have a lot of, yeah, I think we're all proud of each other and man, you're really asking some good questions. You're getting me all you're getting me all teary eyed.
Roll. She's the wind on the flag tipping on the pole. She's the honey on the beat. She's the knocking of my knee. She's a rock.
All right, that is the end of part one with G Love. A million thanks to Garrett for taking time out of his busy schedule to go through my clearly fan-based questions, and also to Mike Hannigan on G-Love's management team for helping organize the interview. Stick around for episode 2, where Garrett talks candidly about his run-ins with the police, we talk about his catalog on vinyl, songs that never made the cut, and a few great stories of touring the world. If you have any questions or comments, drop us a line at info@travelingentertainer.com, guest with two L's. And if you like what you heard, you can subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, TuneIn Alexa, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, pretty much everywhere podcasts are hosted, or you can stream it off the website at www.travelingentertainer.com. In the meantime, until the world gets back to normal, support musicians in any way you can, pick up a copy of G-Love's new release, The Juice, at philadelphonic.com, and make sure you buy a ticket to his next show, whenever that may be. More interviews coming soon. Thanks for listening. Take care.